You're listening to Let's Talk on Talk Radio Europe. We're back in the year 1957, and Ken Fortenbry was only 6 years old when his pilot father left their San Francisco home and never returned. 8 years later, Fortenbry began a one-man lifelong journey of detective work to determine exactly why his father's plane simply vanished without warning in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, only a few minutes after the crew reported that everything was normal. Flight 7 is Missing is the name of the new book about it, and Ken joins us now. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
An extraordinary story. I'm particularly interested in aviation, being a lowly private pilot. And over the last few years, of course, we've seen a spate of these kind of things happening. But this is one I didn't know about. So let's go back to the beginning here. 1957. Tell us a bit about your father then. He was, I believe, a co-pilot and navigator.
That's correct. He had been with Pan Am for 6 or 7 years after World War II. He joined the airline. And had been flying a pretty hefty schedule, primarily in the Pacific with Pan Am. That was one of their main routes at the time, as you may know. And this flight had been scheduled for a couple of weeks. And strangely enough, that he had just talked to my mother about taking all of us on the same route to Honolulu in December for Christmas. So
wow.
It was an interesting time for him as a pilot, obviously. He loved flying with Pan Am, and he loved flying the Stratocruiser.
Yes, and of course, when we're talking real flying in those days, aren't we? Not only was it luxurious for the passengers, but it was quite a different kettle of fish for the actual pilots as well.
Absolutely. And on this flight, he was doubling as a co-pilot and navigator. And in those days, of course, we didn't have a satellite. We didn't have any way to know where we're going, or rather than checking the stars and looking at the track of the flight. And midway across the ocean, the U.S. Coast Guard had at that time a station, an ocean station, a vessel that sat out there to help the planes crossing the ocean determine exactly where they were and help them across the ocean from navigational standpoints. It was a different age for sure. This was a four-prop giant airliner, the biggest, largest, most luxurious airliner of its time. And honestly, it was a plagued airline, not the airline. It had a lot of problems, these big mammoth engines. And there was a joke at one time among some pilots. They had three engines turning and one engine burning.
Goodness me.
And it used an awful lot of oil, for example. And at every stop, the pilots usually got out and personally watched that oil was filled back up into the airplane. So it was a great plane. It was it was a fabulous plane to fly. It had a belly bar. You descended a spiral staircase, and there was a bar downstairs, and it was luxury flying for sure.
Absolutely. In fact, it's a strange looking aircraft. Years later, I think they made variations of it, and they called them the Pregnant Guppy and the Super Guppy and the Mini Guppy.
Absolutely. It was such a huge plane. It was adapted as a pregnant guppy, as you said, and NASA used it primarily to transport a lot of parts. Yeah. So even after it was taken out of commercial service, it was still used, and commercial airline service, it was still used. But, you know, the days of those four-engine planes were dying at this time because Pan Am rolled out his first 707 just the next year. And it was expensive to operate. So it was the end of the piston aircraft age for aviation at any rate.
So the flight went completely normally to a point. There were 44 people aboard, all wearing nice suits and ties, I'm sure, and nice dresses, and the Pan Am smile from the stewardesses. And they were on their way, as you say, from San Francisco to Honolulu. Everything was completely normal. The weather was great. Everything had been thumbs up. And that was at 5 o'clock, and then by 5:30, smoke was filling the passenger cabin. So what was occurring in terms of the radio communications at that point then?
Well, interestingly, Bill, we have no radio communications except for the routine report with the ocean station,
wow,
the Coast Guard station, a little after 5 o'clock. He was on course, everything was proceeding normally, and everything was perfectly fine. Now, there's been some issue as to whether or not the plane mayday'd or did not. But the Civil Aeronautics Board, which was the investigating authority at the time, determined they could not ascertain whether or not the plane actually did send a Mayday signal. And although there were some signals, but they couldn't translate them. They put them through all kinds of extensive testing to determine what was recorded, if it really came from the plane, and what was said, and were never able to determine for sure whether the plane issued a Mayday. And strangely enough, that has been a real search for years. We tried to find any tape recordings of that transmission and have been unable to do so, because I'm convinced if we're able to find them now with the technology we have today, we'd be able to decipher what, if anything, was said and came from that plane in that last few minutes. But again, it went down within 25 minutes after everything is A-OK. It was plunging to the bottom of the ocean.
Goodness me. And of course, from a personal point of view, there you were. You were 6 years old. Your father was on board. He was 35 years old at the time. And the phone went in your home. Your mum had just gone to bed but wasn't yet asleep. And she bizarrely had a premonition and basically answered the phone by saying, "This is Pan Am, isn't it?"
That's correct. You know, she had told me years later, she didn't talk much about this, and we didn't talk much about this at the time. I guess everybody was consumed by grief, I suppose.
Yeah.
But she recalls leaving the airport the day after she dropped him off, the afternoon she dropped him off, and feeling chilly, and something just wasn't right. And she was like that. She had these feelings from time to time. And she said when the phone rang, she knew instantly who it was, and she said, "This is Pan Am, isn't it?" And the person on the other end said, "Yes, it is, Ronnie, and Bill's plane is missing." So, yeah, she had a premonition that it was going down. And throughout the rest of the night, they'd check with her every hour or so to tell her nothing new to be reported. And, you know, by the next morning, it was clear the plane was down in the ocean somewhere, and the big search began.
Now, of course, in those days, I think people are used to air crash investigations these days with the NTSB turning up or the CAA in the UK. And, you know, they've got a lot of technical equipment. They've got black box recorders to look for. They've got voice recorders. They've got a deep sea sonar they can check. And they've got a beacon on board the aircraft. It must have been very different as an investigation. And in the immediate aftermath of them knowing the plane had gone, what were the steps that they took?
Well, they really, you're correct. There was no indication. Of course, they first thought the plane was just had maybe a radio problem.
Yeah.
So they asked other planes that were flying the route to send out signals on all radio frequencies to see if they could reach it. And a number of planes, as a matter of fact, that were flying the area descended and looked to see if they could see anything, a crash on the water or something of that nature. And of course, they, for hours, they simply thought, well, maybe he's got a radio communication problem. Mm. And when it became time for the plane to arrive in Honolulu, it was, of course, nightfall, and they had all of the lights of all the searchlights and all the vessels in Pearl Harbor turn on their lights. Wow. Just in case the plane could not radio communicate to the tower and had some difficulty getting there to be able to see, you know, their lights there. That's Honolulu. That's where we're going.
Yeah.
And of course, at that stage, there was a point that the gas would have run out, the fuel would run out of the plane. It
yeah.
was clearly down. So the Coast Guard and commercial aircraft and commercial vessels, boats, were asked to look for this plane before the official search got underway. And you know, it was at the time the most massive air sea search since Amelia Earhart's plane went missing.
And of course, again, they've no idea where it is, because unlike now, there would be no radar track of an aircraft in 1957 going across the Pacific.
Absolutely. But again, at 5 o'clock, they knew where it was. They
yeah.
had a good position report. But again, they don't know whether it was 2 hours later or 3 hours later or whatever when the thing went down. So they had a massive area that I think one of the Coast Guard searchers said it was like searching for a needle in a haystack. They just
yeah.
really had nowhere to search.
It was a year-long process after that that didn't get resolved either by Pan Am or by Boeing, who would have stepped in, or the Civil Aeronautics Board, the predecessor of the NTSB. And I guess that at some point they call a halt to it with no conclusion. Now, in most cases, that would kind of be the end of that, but that wasn't the end of it for you, was it?
No, Bill, it wasn't, and it started me on this lifelong journey. Look, I'm a kid. I'm 6 years old when I lost my father. And
Yeah.
like most kids that age, I guess you look up to your dad so much. And I honestly, as I say in this book, I really expected him to come just walking through the door one day.
Course.
And it didn't happen, of course. And by the time I'm 14 years old, I'm saying, I got to look into this some more. And I wrote a letter to the Civil Aeronautics Board because their final report said that investigation was continuing into this crash. So I thought, surely after, 7 years, they've got something new to report.
Yeah.
And they sent me a letter back a week or so later saying, essentially, we've done nothing and what you have is what you have. And that really irritated me. I
Yeah.
mean, even as a kid as 14, I'm saying, you can't let a plane go down with 44 people aboard and have no explanation and just be bureaucrats and walk away. And they did. And it set me off into this lifelong search.
Extraordinary that at 14 you would have the wherewithal to be able to even tackle huge organizations in government and civil aviation to even know what questions to ask.
Well, the central question simply was why?
Yeah.
Why did it go down?
Yeah.
And beyond that, through the years, obviously, many more questions developed. But I was so irritated, even as a kid, Bill, to realize that they just walked away from this thing,
Yeah.
and to leave the report on the desk, and then ultimately, in a file drawer somewhere, and forget it. And they just forgot it. And I wasn't about to forget it.
Amazing. Now, the theories, of course, were many, as there always are when aircraft go down. Was it mechanical failure? Were the communist Chinese paying the US back for a plot to assassinate their premier? Was a UFO involved? Or was it an act of mass murder-suicide committed by one of the people aboard? Very difficult questions to answer. So how did you go about your quest, which took you all that time?
Well, very good questions, Bill. Let me say this. At first, again, I'm 14 years old looking at this thing. There was a mention in the news, some newspapers, of a fellow who boarded the plane who had owned a fishing lodge in Northern California who was deeply in debt. And he was also had also been an underwater demolitions fellow in the Navy during the war. Knew how to use dynamite and used it in the mining operations that he had in conjunction with his lodge, and supposedly was going to Honolulu to collect a debt. He bought a one-way ticket, no return. No one knew why he was going there, and other he said to collect a debt. And one of the insurance companies simply refused to pay. They determined that they had no proof the guy got on the plane. Of course, back in those days, we had no security checks like we have today. You could
Sure.
have gotten on an airplane in my name, for example,
Yeah.
and no one really cared. And they had no proof that he was on board, so they refused to pay the widow's claims. He also bought over $1 million in today's value of life insurance in the couple of weeks before the plane crash. So he was a very suspicious fella, and all signs kind of pointed to him
Yep.
as a possible suspect because, again, the insurance company refused to pay. And the other possibility was the propellers on the plane, an engine failure. So I had two P's. The guy was the suspect was last name Payne, and the other P was the propellers.
Wow.
So I worked those two angles for years. The Payne fellow, the guy who had been the underwater demolitions expert, was very, very suspect. And I found out that a fellow had been hired by the insurance company to investigate him, and finally reached him on the phone 8, 9, 10 years later, and he was petrified. He wouldn't
Wow.
talk to me on the telephone. He said these people would stop at nothing. We were convinced that he was alive and well in Mexico, and it was an insurance fraud. And over the next, oh gosh, I don't know, 20 years or so, Bill, he would not talk with me. He was afraid for what might happen to him. He was just paranoid about it. So again, my whole focus is on this fellow Payne, and I start to develop biographical information on him, and he doesn't exist. There's really nothing about his life in the world. I still, to this day, don't have a picture of this fellow.
Incredible.
And his family didn't have a memorial service for him. They just kind of faded away, and he was very, very suspect. So those were my two initially.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, these days they would try and find the aircraft underwater, wouldn't they? And they'd maybe find something that would give them a clue. Was any attempt made, or was it just not a non-starter?
No, they didn't have the ability to just search underwater in those days. And again, you've got to remember, this was a 70-ton aircraft, and what few pieces floated to the top of the ocean during the search, you could have put in a few boxes. There just was not much left of it. And, of course, that leads to maybe the thing broke up in a million pieces, or it still could be in two very large pieces at the bottom of the ocean. But they didn't have that capability at the time, and you know, after they recovered the bodies and what little wreckage they could, they wrapped it up and headed back to California for the investigation.
So in the book, you make a very convincing case for what or who you believe caused the crash. Is it something you have come to an absolute conclusion about, or not?
Bill, let me say, I don't think there will be an absolute conclusion until and unless someone finds wreckage at the bottom of the ocean that could prove me wrong. But I've got to say that after wrestling with every possibility for 50 plus years now, 60 years really, and exhausting everything that was available, let me tell you what, I cannot begin to tell you how many documents and how many interviews I've conducted through the years.
Sure.
I don't think there's anyone on the planet who has more information about this plane than I do. Of course, I had a very personal interest in it, and I would.
Yeah.
And I wrestled so many times with the propeller, the mechanical issues, this fellow Payne, and then my third suspect, which I didn't even know about until maybe 20 years after the plane went down. He was never made public in any way. And I had been fighting with one federal agency for months, I mean, for years, for some documents. And one day a fella just, I just begged him, please see you again. Have you got anything there that you haven't given me? And he mentioned the purser on the airplane. Well, this had never come up. It had never been made public in any way. And that was a whole new ball game for me.
Interesting.
So then I spent an awful lot of time pursuing him until I ran out of possibilities on that. So, you know, at one time I'm convinced it's mechanical failure. The next time I'm convinced it's this fellow who owned the hunting lodge, fishing lodge. And then I have this new suspect, the purser on the plane that I spend years and years investigating.
Extraordinary. And of course, the irony in all of this is that even now, in the days that we sit in, where the technical advances that have been made since your father's aircraft went down, we still have aircraft like the Malaysian aircraft that just disappear exactly in the same way that your father's aircraft did, and they have no idea what happened to that. So we've not come very far, have we?
We really haven't, in so many ways. And you know, every time something like that happens, it just tears my guts out.
Yeah.
And I think about the Malaysia Air flight particularly, and all those people, all those families, and how they're still suffering today with no answers. And again, you're right. The technology that we have today, that should never have happened.
Absolutely.
We should have been able to zero in on it. But back in these days, listen, this was really pretty early days of commercial aviation anyway.
Yeah.
And we just didn't have the capability that we have today. So we've come a long way in so many ways. You've mentioned the black boxes and all the technology, the satellite tracking, everything we have. But yet you still have these mysteries that occur, and people are left without answers.
Absolutely. Well, you can't, nobody could say, having read that book, that you certainly have tried every avenue that could possibly be tried by anyone. So your father's looking down on you, at least being very proud of you, I'm sure, Ken. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about it. The book is called Flight 7 is Missing, and Ken Fortenberry is our guest, and he's the author of the book. Ken, an absolute privilege to talk to you, sir. What a life's work, and let's just keep our fingers crossed that maybe one day something just comes and gets this problem solved.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Bill. I appreciate it.